In fact, there was a little misprint in the announcement. I will not talk about statistical mechanics of 2D vortices in stellar systems, but I will talk about statistical mechanics of 2D vortices and stellar systems. So these are, of course, on a physical point of view, very different physical systems, two-dimensional vortices and three-dimensional, almost spherical, stellar systems. So they are physically very different, but I will show that there are some analogy and that we can understand their structure and organization in terms of similar statistical mechanics. So as you know, the main property of two-dimensional turbulence is that it self-organizes spontaneously into coherent structures, the vortices, that are stable and that are long-lived in 2D. So typically we observe three kinds of vortices in two-dimensional flows: monopole structures, dipole structures, translating or rotating, and tripole structures. And in general, these vortices coexist as isolated structures, as kind of bubbles in the same turbulent background, where you can see as isolated structures, monopoles, dipoles, and tripoles. These vortices are also found in geophysical or astrophysical flows. The main example is Jupiter's red spot. There is also the dark spot of Neptune. So these are monopole vortices. Dipole vortices, a pair of cyclone anticyclone, are also found on Earth, and they are responsible for what meteorologists call a situation of atmospheric blocking. So these are dipole structures. And finally, tripole structures have also been observed in real flows. For example, this one in the Bay of Biscay. This is an oceanic vortex with the central vortex and the two satellites. So these vortices are hydrodynamical structures described by equations of fluid mechanics, Navier-Stokes equation or Euler equation for high Reynolds number. But now, in another context, it is striking to observe that galaxies also follow a kind of organization revealed in the Hubble classification or in de Vaucouleurs R14 flow for the structure of elliptical galaxies that seems to be remarkably alike. So in the following, I will consider essentially two types of stellar systems that are typically three-dimensional, almost spherical. So elliptical galaxies that are huge systems with a large number of stars. And in such systems, the collisions between stars are almost completely negligible. So these elliptical galaxies are described by the Vlasov equation that I shall show. And the other system that I will be concerned with are globular clusters that are smaller clusters of stars. And in globular clusters, collisions or encounters between stars have to be taken into account.
Yes,
correct. Yes?
The wording called collisions is that
it's encounter, it's deflection due to body encounters.
So since the gravitational interaction is long wave, so they are always colliding, aren't they?
Well, direct collisions are very rare and they occur very rarely, but deflections are more frequent, in particular in globular clusters, and they drive relaxation towards the equilibrium state. But it's never collision, direct collisions like in a gas, it's always deflection due to long-range gravity field. So the object of the talk is to show that there is some analogy between two-dimensional vortices and three-dimensional almost spherical stellar systems, and that we can develop a similar statistical mechanism. So let's first consider the two-dimensional Euler equation written like this. This is the advection of the vorticity by an incompressible velocity field in two dimensions. But the vorticity is not a passive scalar. There is a coupling between the vorticity and the velocity field through a Poisson equation relating the vorticity to the stream function. And if we start from this kind of initial condition, a stripe of uniform vorticity sigma zero surrounded by a rotational flow, The stripe is unstable. This is a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. A mixing process will take place in the plane, at the end of which a coherent structure, here a vortex, is formed. And some people, including Kuzmin, Miller, and Robert and Someria, have proposed to interpret this equilibrium state as a most mixed state compatible with the constraints of the Euler equation. So in this simple case where we start from a stripe of uniform vorticity, there are only two constraints to take into account, the conservation of energy and of the circulation. So they introduced a mixing entropy that takes into account this mixing process, and they maximize this mixing entropy at fixed energy and circulation. So in particular,
the question about the simulation looks dissipative.
Yes, it's always dissipative, but
I mean, if you start with a piecewise constant or a uniform structure, you will never get what you see at the end.
Yes, because this is on a coarse grain scale that you have this equilibrium structure. You have to the exact vorticity field. I didn't want to develop this, but maybe I can do it with transparencies if you are interested in. So you have to distinguish, and it's a very important fact, between the fine-grain vorticity solution of the Euler equation that will never achieve equilibrium state but that will develop an intricate filamentation. So on a microscopic scale, the vorticity takes only two values, sigma zero and zero in the previous example. But then we define a coarse-grain vorticity field, a local average of the fine-grain vorticity field, and this will achieve an equilibrium state. So at a microscopic scale, the vorticity takes only two values, sigma zero and zero, but making very intricate filamentation. And then we introduce a coarse graining, so we take the local average of the exact vorticity field on a cell of size epsilon square, defining the coarse grain vorticity as the local average of the exact vorticity. And this coarse grain vorticity can take values between sigma zero, if the macro cell is completely black, completely occupied by the level sigma zero, and zero if it is completely empty.
So it, how do you decide on epsilon?
Epsilon is the resolution scale, so in the statistical theory, at the end, epsilon goes to zero, but otherwise we work always with a finite resolution, and this is the resolution scale of our simulation or of the observations. We never have a complete, an absolute precision on the vorticity field. We always make a coarse graining, so epsilon would be the coarse graining. But in fact, because of viscosity makes by itself a coarse graining. So we can consider that.
Think of a turbulent viscosity, it could be more important than a normal viscosity. In other words, to me there's something non-unique about talking about this to the limit and then looking at things that are finite time evolutions. There's a big gap between coarse graining and asymptotics and a simulation that's very, really very short time. But anyway, I think I'm not going to hold you up on that. I just want to make a point.
Okay. So we can now introduce the local probability of vorticity level sigma zero. This is more or less the proportion of the vorticity level sigma zero in that macro cell. And the constraint vorticity is simply the probability of finding the vorticity level sigma zero times the value sigma zero of that level. Now we can introduce a mixing entropy. It is simply the entropy of the level sigma zero, so P log P integrated in over the whole domain, plus the entropy of the other level, zero, of probability 1 minus P, so the entropy is 1 minus P log 1 minus P integrated over the whole domain. So this entropy counts the number of microstates of microscopic configuration corresponding to the same macrostate given by the local proportion of vorticity sigma zero in R. So people have constructed this mixing entropy, and the maximization of this mixing entropy at fixed energy and circulation yields a Fermi-Dirac distribution. And in this semi-direct distribution, beta is a Lagrange multiplier associated with the energy constraint. So it's a semi-direct distribution because we have a kind of exclusion principle like in quantum mechanics, but for another reason. It's simply because the constraint vorticity can never take values larger than sigma zero. So we have a kind of exclusion principle, a constraint on the constraint vorticity, and this leads to the Fermi-Dirac statistics. So in fact, this statistical mechanics was introduced previously by Lindenbaum in 1967 in the case of the Vlasov equation describing collisionless stellar systems like elliptical galaxies. So the Vlasov equation in six-dimensional phase space has a structure similar to the 2D Euler equation. It is a transport of the distribution function f that gives the average number of stars in position r with velocity v at time t. And there is a coupling between the star density, the integral of the distribution function over the velocity, and the gravitational potential. So this coupling is similar to this one in 2D Euler flows. So once again, we have a mixing process in phase space that corresponds to the oscillation of the galaxy when it is dynamically unsteady. And Lindenbaum introduced a mixing entropy, maximized the mixing entropy at fixed energy and mass, and obtained, in this case, when we have only one level of distribution function, a simple Fermi-Dirac statistic for the coarse-grained distribution function. Once again, we have to make a distinction between fine-grained and coarse-grained distribution function.
But you know, in the Vlasov story, there is no diffusion.
There is no diffusion.
We have only convection in the semi-dimensional space. There is nobody got diffusion here. So the two dynamics are not quite alike.
No, it's alike in the. They are similar in the limit of infinite Reynolds number for the Euler equation. Now, the main property of this form of relaxation, as compared to relaxation of particles, is that it's very efficient, it's extremely rapid. After only one or two rotations, only a few turns AD over time, and we speak of a violent relaxation following Lindenbell, and the time of relaxation by phase mixing is of the order of the dynamical time, and it's relevant in the case of elliptical galaxies for which collisions are completely negligible. Now we can see the analogy between stellar systems and two-dimensional vortices. If we consider now an ensemble of n point mass stars in gravitational interaction, or n point vortices, these systems are Hamiltonian systems. In the case of stellar systems, the Hamiltonian is usual. The position and velocity are canonically conjugate, and the Hamiltonian has a potential and a kinetic part. But in the case of 2D vortices, the Hamiltonian is really very special, because it's now the coordinates of the point vortices, x and y, that are canonically conjugate, and the Hamiltonian is, in a sense, only potential. There is no quadratic term like usual Hamiltonian. It's only a kind of potential energy. And this has important physical consequences, because in the case of stellar systems, the temperature is necessarily positive because it is a measure of the kinetic energy, whereas in the case of point vortices, as shown by Onsager, negative temperatures are possible, and it is precisely at negative temperatures that vortices will cluster into large-scale structures. On the other hand, in the case of stellar systems, we can have a collapse instability called the gravothermal instability or gravothermal catastrophe. The system can collapse at fixed energy because it can make the potential energy very negative under the condition that the kinetic energy is very positive. So you can have this collapse at fixed energy. And it's not possible for point vortices of the same sign, because if you collapse them, you will not conserve the energy that is purely potential. There is no quadratic term to store potential energy. So you don't have the equivalent of the collapse instability for 2D vortices.
But you have collapse in 3D vortex dynamics.
Yes, but it's a different story.
Yeah, okay. Nature is
Ask a question about that. When you're talking about you don't have collapse in 2D vortex dynamics, you're talking about simultaneous collapse of all the vortices?
Yes.
Okay, you're not talking about some subgroup of vortices colliding?
No.
Okay, but that you can certainly have.
So now this Hamiltonian system, due to the development of correlations, I expected to achieve a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution function, called also the Joyce-Montgomery statistics in 2D turbulence. And this is obtained by maximizing the Boltzmann entropy at fixed energy and mass of stellar systems, or fixed energy and circulation for 2D vortices. And this relaxation, due to collisions, is much slower than in the previous case, that in the case of phase mixing. And the time of relaxation scales like n times the dynamical time, where n is the number of particles in the system. So for example, this relaxation by collisions is efficient in the case of globular clusters, and the globular cluster can be described by isothermal distribution functions. Now the analogy between stellar systems and 2D vortices is intimately related to the phenomenon of negative temperatures, because the equilibrium state will be obtained by substituting in the Newton-Poisson equation the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, and it gives, for the gravitational potential, a mean field equation of that form. We have a similar mean field equation for the stream function in two-dimensional turbulence. And now, if we compare the differential equations, in the case of stellar systems, the temperature is necessarily positive, but in the case of 2D vortices, temperature can be positive or negative. And we see that when the temperature here is negative, the two differential equations have the same form, and consequently, at negative temperatures, the interaction between vortices becomes attractive, like gravity, and the solutions of these differential equations use the profile, the density profile, density, star density or vorticity density profile, that decays from the center to the periphery of the system. So it corresponds to a clustering at negative temperature. On the other hand, at positive temperature, the interaction between point vortices is in a sense repulsive, like electric charges, and the vortices at positive temperatures are pushed against the boundary of the domain.
Can you explain exactly what you mean that they have the same form? You have e to the minus beta star on the left, phi, which is like psi, and minus beta vortex psi. So if you have a negative on one side, you have a...
The same. First, you set psi equal minus phi.
Okay. So okay.
But it's of course...
That's enough.
Okay. So now we can try to see if the predictions of the statistical theory are consistent with the experiments on numerical simulation. So we look again at this example. We want to see if this final state is consistent with the Fermi-Dirac distribution. So we take this equilibrium state and we plot log of omega divided by sigma 0 minus omega versus the strength function. And we observe that we have a linear relationship in the core of the vortex, so that corresponds to the Fermi-Dirac statistics. So the statistical theory works well in the core of the vortex, where fluctuations and mixing were efficient to sustain the ergodicity hypothesis. But outside the vortex, there is less and less mixing, ergodicity is violated, and the statistical theory doesn't work. You see that the disagreement is worse and worse, far away from the central region. So this means that we must not maximize, in general, entropy in the whole domain, but only in a subdomain where fluctuation and mixing were sufficiently strong to validate an ergodicity hypothesis. So this means that vortices are not maximum entropy states, but rather restricted maximum entropy states or maximum entropy bubbles. Yes?
I'd like to come back to the point that Norm brought up. It just seems like these statistical conclusions depend on how you do your coarse grains, on the relative coarse grain scale to other scales that are important in the problem, such as the macroscopic scale and the microscopic scale of individual vortex filaments. And it also seems to me that this last result is partly related to how good your statistics are. If your force strength scale is large enough in a certain region of your domain to have a lot of samples so that you have, you know, good quality distributions, as it were, then, you know, if indeed your R is equal to Branch State, you would expect better correspondence. But in the outer fringes of the vortex, perhaps you don't have enough filaments of vorticity through your coarse grain boxes, where you don't. So this could be simply a reflection of the statistics breaking down, not enough samples.
Well, first of all, I think there is as a function of epsilon's resolution scale, there is a range of epsilon for which the result should be independent of epsilon. This is almost an hypothesis for the validity of this theory. There must be some range of resolution for which the results are independent of the resolution itself. Of course, if epsilon goes to zero, we should see more and more the filamentation, but there should be a kind of average range.
For the theory to work, that has to be true.
Yes.
But you haven't sort of shown any data to suggest that, in fact, it is true, for example.
No, I agree. No, it's not well studied and understood. But
in fact, there are experiments on the issue, and they also show that the statistical state depends on initial conditions, is how the experiment is prepared itself. So it's even beyond, I think, the issue of finite time.
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. I mean, this calculation could easily be redone with different coarse grain.
In fact, it's difficult because in that case you always have viscosity, and it will make the coarse graining by itself. It will erase the filamentation. So it's difficult to make a study to look at the influence of the resolution on the equilibrium state, because of viscosity that you have in your Navier-Stokes simulation, you will have a coarse graining.
I thought you said this was Euler.
No, it's modeled by Euler, but we can never make a Euler simulation for a long time because of the filaments at small scales. So it's always compared with Navier-Stokes simulation at high resolution, and the viscosity inherent in the simulation makes by itself a coarse graining. So it's why it's difficult to study
the influence of the minimum coarse grain scale, which is set by Reynolds number.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Let me just make one comment about your question. I mean, it's true that if you choose different epsilon, then the exact point where the incomplete relaxation kicks in will obviously change. But I think his point is that once you fix an epsilon, then you look at this curve, then there's going to be a region where you have converged statistics
and a region
where you don't.
Right. Now, again, you can see how that vertical line changes as a function of how you do your coarse grain.
Yeah. But it's difficult because of viscosity that.
What is the power of it? In other words, or I should say, how does omega depend on R? You just took some radius around the maximum. Is it like a 1 minus R squared, which is what one normally expects?
In this region?
No. That's against psi. But just take omega versus R, and just get a feeling. It's probably 1 minus R squared. So what you're seeing is, in other words, right, it has to be. It's a local maximum. So
when
you took an expansion of omega around the maximum,
yes.
It would be 1 minus R squared.
Around the maximum, yes.
Yes. So isn't that what we're really seeing here? I mean, the first order, that straight line is just the curvature of the vorticity in that region. I mean, for example, well, the thing starts off where omega is a maximum. I don't understand. Yeah, so it starts off where omega is a maximum.
But look at this this one, where we plot the log of omega
as
a function of psi. Mm-hmm. We don't have a straight line in that case. So this distinguishes between Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, like in point vorticity theories, and Fermi-Dirac theories. So it's more than simply the behavior near the maximum. Otherwise, you would have the same straight line in both situations. So it's more, it brings more results than simply an expansion around the maximum. And for the other question concerning incomplete relaxation is relatively clear from a physical point of view, because if you have a situation of that kind, where you inject vorticity only in a finite domain as compared to the experimental domain, there is no reason to maximize entropy in the whole domain. Because the mixing process will take place only in this subdomain that is difficult to determine a priori, but we understand that mixing and ergodicity will happen typically only in that region, if it has a chance to happen, but not in the whole region. So we expect in any case that there is a discrepancy for at large distances of the mixing region, independently of the formalism of the theory. And
I don't understand what you just said, frankly. But anyway, let's go back to the dipole. The dipole shows that from this chaotic state emerges a simple state, right?
Yes.
A chaotic or jet state. And then out of it comes a... Now, if you did that study in the center of that vortex there, wouldn't you get the same state line? Is that what you're saying?
No.
No?
Okay. Wait.
That's really what you're saying.
Okay. This example is simple to study and to compare with the statistical prediction because you have only one vorticity level initially. So the prediction of the statistical theory is a simple Fermi-Dirac distribution. Mm-hmm. So if you plot this quantity as a function of psi, if it is a straight line, you know that it is the Fermi-Dirac distribution. It's a very simple change of variable to validate or not the statistical theory. But in the other case, in the case of the dipole, you have many levels to take into account. We cannot make the approximation that it is a patch, an initial patch. And in that case, and I will come back on it later, the prediction of the statistical theory is much more complicated than simply a Fermi-Dirac distribution. It's a sum of Fermi-Dirac distribution over all the vorticity levels. And in the case of the dipole, maybe you have 100 vorticity levels.
No, you can do the dipole just initially two vortex levels.
So you
only have two instead of one.
In that case, the study could be...
So it should still be Fermi-Dirac, right?
Two Fermi-Dirac.
Yeah,
but even in the case of two Fermi-Dirac, it's not so easy. You don't have
I mean, nature, I'm not making the jump away. Nature has many levels of vorticity.
Yes.
Plus and minus constantly interacting.
Yes, I will come back on it, but
okay.
To start with, we start with a simple case to see at least in the simple case that we can study the roughly, it works or not.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of a patch, it seems to work and we can make a complete study. But I agree that then, we have to take a lot of levels into account, but I will show how we can make some approximation to study this.
So, but the preparation of initial data difference is going to give you a different statistic.
Yes. Okay. So, an important point is that it seems to work, but not everywhere, because there is incomplete relaxation. And we have the same problem, I will not develop this, but there is the same problem in astrophysics for the Lindenberg theory. Once again, people knew from the 60s that the relaxation was incomplete and the statistical theory holds only in the zone where the galaxy is relatively unsteady, but the distribution function has to be truncated at large ready because there is no ergodicity at large ready. And on the other hand, in the case of stellar systems, you have another problem, that is the escape of high-energy stars. High-energy stars will escape from the system and go to infinity, and consequently, the Maxwell-Boltzmann or Fermi-Dirac distribution are not valid for high energies because of the escape of high-energy stars, and they must be truncated also. So it's another cause of incomplete relaxation in stellar systems. Yes?
Will it help to decrease this discrepancy?
At least in this case you just have as conserved quantity energy and circulation, that's all.
Are you referring to the higher moments of vorticity?
No, they're the same because you have a patch initially. So the moment of order n, you can write it similarly. Because on a fine grained scale, the vorticity can take only two values, 0 or sigma 0. So when it has value 0, the integral is 0, and otherwise it has value sigma 0. So it's equivalent to write this integral as this one, because you only have one vorticity level. So you see that all the moments are proportional to the circulation. The moment of order n is simply proportional to the circulation. So you only have, because you have only one vorticity level, one moment to take into account. You just have to conserve the area of the patch. The patch will deform in a very complicated way, but its area, or equivalently its circulation, will be conserved. And the only constraint that you have to take into account, in addition, of course, to energy. But in more complicated situations, I agree that you have a large number of moments to take into account. But that's why people started with this simple case, because the prediction is very straightforward in that case, and it can be studied in detail. In more general situation, even the prediction is difficult to obtain, so comparison with observations is difficult. Okay, so the main one important problem is the phenomenon of incomplete relaxation, both in 2D turbulence and for stellar systems. And to understand incomplete relaxation, we have now to go beyond equilibrium statistical mechanics and study the relaxation towards the equilibrium to see what limits complete relaxation. So I first considered the case of stars because it was treated historically first. So in particular, the kinetic theory of collisional stellar systems was considered by Chandra Sekhar in 1943 by analogy with Brownian motion. And this analogy is due to the fact that the gravitational potential is long range, so that a given star will suffer a large number of weak deflections. Each encounter gives a weak deflection, but since it's long range, you have a large number of deflections. So you can make a diffusion approximation, and Chandra Sekhar started with a Fokker-Planck equation for the evolution of the distribution function. And in a heuristic work, he calculated the first and second moments of the velocity increments by using stochastic Langevin equation. So he said that the velocity increment suffered by a star due to collision is due, first of all, to a stochastic force that takes into account the effect of fluctuations or collision. But you know that if there are fluctuations, there must be also dissipation, because of the fluctuation-dissipation theorem in statistical mechanics. So you have to take into account the dynamical friction in addition to this stochastic force. And it took a dynamical friction proportional and opposite to the star velocity. So with this Langevin equation, it's possible to calculate the first and second moment of the velocity increment, and it gives the following Kramer-Chandra-Sekhar equation for the evolution of the distribution function towards equilibrium for collisional stellar systems. And now the coefficients of diffusion and friction are not independent, but they are related by an Einstein relation that is obtained simply by stating that at equilibrium, the Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics must cancel this diffusion current. And if you substitute the Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics in this equation at equilibrium, you obtain this relationship between C, the coefficient of dynamical friction, D, the diffusion coefficient, beta, the inverse temperature, and M, the mass of the stars. Now it is possible to show that we can also obtain this equation from a different point of view, from a variational principle that extends what we do at equilibrium. At equilibrium, in order to obtain the Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics, we maximize the Boltzmann entropy at fixed energy and mass. Now, if out of equilibrium we maximize the rate of entropy production, dS over dt at fixed energy and mass, we obtain directly this equation. And the interest of this variational principle is that it can be applied in more general situations. So for example, it can be used to obtain a kinetic equation for the core strains relaxation of collisionless stellar systems. So in the viewpoint of Lyndon Bell, to obtain a relaxation equation that will lead the system towards Lyndon Bell statistics. So the equation is very similar to the Kramer-Chandrasekhar equation, but it is obtained from this variational principle. So there is a diffusion in velocity space that is obtained in the variational principle from the variation of entropy. So it shows that fluctuations are related to entropy, so it's good on a physical point of view. And the other term, that is a dynamical friction, is obtained in the variational principle due to the conservation of energy. And beta is formally a time-dependent Lagrange multiplier associated with the conservation of energy. So the Einstein relationship and the effect of the dynamical friction is automatically satisfied by this variational principle, the maximum entropy production principle. Finally, we observe that the friction coefficient, contrary to the Kramer-Chandrasekhar equation, is nonlinear with respect to the distribution function. And this nonlinearity will drive the system towards the Fermi-Dirac or Lyndon-Bell distribution function, whereas in that case, the relaxation goes towards the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution function. So degeneracy can be incorporated out of equilibrium in this nonlinear friction term.
So the nonlinear friction term is chosen so as to relax to Fermi Dirac.
It arises naturally in this variational principle. If you maximize the rate of entropy production at fixed energy and mass, you will have this nonlinear term as a result of the calculation with no hypothesis.
But then how do we
the hypothesis is here that this principle is correct. But since it's correct in the case of collisional systems, we can try to apply it also for collision-less system and also in 2D turbulence, as I will show in a minute. So it's a very general variational principle for the relaxation out of equilibrium.
So I thought that measurement entropy related to the Fermi Dirac for this entropy production, entropy rate.
In the case of collisional point mass star, the final equilibrium state due to collisions is the Maxwell-Boltzmann statistic. Now, for collisionless stellar systems undergoing phase mixing, violent relaxation, the final equilibrium state is the Fermi-Dirac statistic. So it depends on the system under consideration.
So it's a very simple principle to get the final result.
Yes. Okay. So now we can use these kinetic equations to obtain truncated models that will take into account the escape of high-energy stars. I told you previously that the problem of the Maxwell-Boltzmann or Fermi-Dirac statistics is that it doesn't take into account the escape of high-energy stars. But now we can look for stationary solutions of this kinetic equation with the additional constraint that the distribution function cancels is zero at some critical finite energy. That will be seen as being the escape energy. So we can look for stationary solutions of this equation with a boundary condition f of epsilon m. So epsilon m is escape energy equals zero. And in that case, in the case of the Kramer-Chandrasekhar equation, the stationary state is the Michiting model. It's simply the Maxwell-Boltzmann statistic minus a constant, so that when epsilon equals epsilon m, the distribution function is zero. So you don't have stars with energy larger than epsilon m. They have escaped to infinity or have been captured by the gravity of other systems.
But then if epsilon is greater than epsilon m, but that's not zero anymore.
Excuse me?
If epsilon is greater than epsilon m, that's not zero anymore. How do you handle that?
For epsilon larger than epsilon m,
then that
f equals zero. The stars have escaped.
But I don't know, that won't seem to take care of that.
food?
Just saying that it will be zero. Mm-hmm. You're saying that that's fine.
Epsilon is less than epsilon m. The escape of stars is such that above the critical energy, the escape energy, there is no the stars have left the system because it has been captured by another system.
But that doesn't seem to take care of that, you know. That doesn't seem to take care of that. But it appears to me that we have to put a condition at work.
Equals zero? Okay, I agree. Because otherwise it's negative. But it's because the truncation is strictly valid only for energy close and less than epsilon m.
Yeah.
So it's okay. But it's clear on physical grounds that F equals zero for energy larger than epsilon m. It's we solve this differential equation with the boundary condition that F equals zero at epsilon m, and then we consider that F equals zero because the stars have escaped. So. And we can find also a truncated model for this equation that takes into account the degeneracy associated with the Lindenbell statistics. So the truncated model is the following. For negative energy, it reduces to the Fermi-Dirac or Lindenbell statistics, and for epsilon close to epsilon m, the limit energy, it is close to the Michiking model. So once again, this takes into account the escape of high energy stars and also the degeneracy of collisionless stellar systems. So this can take into account the effect of incomplete relaxation because of escape of high energy stars. So now we can try to formulate a kinetic theory for two-dimensional vortices. So first of all, we note that the dynamical friction experienced by a star can be understood as a result of a polarization process. Let's consider a given star, a test star, in a field of n stars at equilibrium. So in a first approximation, the test star will follow the mean field created by the other stars, but in addition, it will create a polarization process in the sense that it will attract the surrounding stars. And this will create a polarization cloud which amounts to region of enhanced density that tails behind it. And the retroaction of this polarization cloud will produce a force that will decelerate the star under consideration. So this is the physical origin of the dynamical friction in stellar systems. And now we can apply a similar argument to show that in 2D turbulence, a point vortex will experience a systematic drift, the analogous of the dynamical friction. So we make a thermal bath approximation. We consider an ensemble of n point vortices at equilibrium, described by the Joyce-Montgomery statistics. And we assume that beta is negative, because we have seen that it is the relevant temperature for 2D turbulence. So that the number of vortices or density of vortices decreases from the center to the periphery. And now we add a new point vortex, the test vortex. In the first approximation, it will follow the mean field, but it will also create a polarization cloud, which amounts to local rotation of the vortices. And since there are more vortices near the center than at the periphery, this will create more vortices behind it than in front of it, and consequently, the retraction of this polarization cloud will lead to a velocity, a drift, towards the center of the system. So we can calculate this drift exactly with a linear response theory in a thermal bath approximation and show that it has the following form. It is perpendicular to the mean field velocity, and the drift coefficient is given by the generalization of the Einstein relation, where beta is the inverse temperature, gamma is the circulation of the point vortex, and this is the diffusion coefficient given by the Kubo formula. And now we see that when beta is negative, the drift is directed inward, so the vortices have the tendency to form aggregates, to form clusters at negative temperature. And when beta is positive, the drift is directed outward, and the vortices have the tendency to be ejected against the wall of the domain. So this is consistent with Onsager thermodynamical approach, but this drift provides a mechanism by a polarization process from the cohesion of point vortices at negative temperature.
This
say, again, why is it that your test vortex moves in the direction of the green arrow when you have your polarization path the way you've drawn it? I don't quite understand that.
You consider the velocity due to this group of vortices and this one. So this group of vortices will create a velocity like this in that direction, and this one at the bottom. But since there are more circulation here than here, the resulting velocity will be inward.
The sign of the
voice will
be the same?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's the opposite, but okay. They are the same in this situation. Yes?
Does the effect depend on R?
Excuse me?
Does the effect depend on R, the distance from the center of plasticity?
In the sense that it depends on R through the stream function, that depends on R, and also through the diffusion coefficient, that is a space-dependent diffusion coefficient.
Close to zero at zero? Yeah. I mean, where zero is the center of what is.
Well, this goes to zero.
That doesn't go to zero.
Right.
Yeah,
the gradient, okay.
The gradient goes to zero, yes. So it's okay.
Typically, the progression cloud must completely surround the star, is that right?
It's behind the star.
And you got that wake behind the star.
Yes.
As the star moves, if the star is stationary, the neighboring stars are coming close to it and then they form a cloud. But as the star starts moving, and then these stars are directed to the previous positions of the star. So they go to the wake.
Yes.
So they go to the wake.
It's behind them. The star moves in this direction, and the polarization cloud is behind it.
So there is an excess.
Of stars behind the test star.
No, that kind of produces some kind of imbalance in the star distribution. And this is just like the dynamic shielding of a test particle in plasma. So there's a charge imbalance there. There's some, I would imagine there's some kind of mass imbalance, and it modifies the potential of the star. Typically, the star is the 1 over r rotational potential, right? But when this happens, I would imagine that the potential will go like 1 over r cubed. If the motion complicates the shielding.
I agree that it's not as simple as when it's growing.
Then we have to talk about how fast the star is moving compared with the thermal velocity of the mean velocity of the star. It's slow motion, fast motion, and all kinds of other things.
This would infer the diffusion coefficient or the dynamical friction, but this has to be calculated precisely. Cannot be obtained simply from this picture.
Because the screening is a complicated dynamical process. How fast the star is moving. If it moves too fast, no screening, no friction. If it moves very slow, then it will experience screening.
Well, the diffusion coefficient or the dynamical friction is a function of the velocity. So. This is where enters the detail argument.
That depends on how fast the star is moving.
It does depend on how fast the star is moving.
If it moves too fast, then there is no friction.
It goes to zero, but there is one. But the diffusion coefficient decays like 1 over v cubed, something like this. Mm-hmm. This has to be obtained by a detailed calculation. This is simply the physical feature for this phenomenon. But a linear response theory provides all the information for the exact value of the friction or of the twist. But you have to start from a Liouville equation and make machinery.
Mm-hmm. With the test vortex problem, why is the cloud to the right smaller than the content of the cloud to the left? Polarization clouds.
Because this one comes from the external region of the vortex.
But where is the external region? Could be anywhere, right? I could move the test particle in, so.
Yes, but in any case, you will always have a larger density at the center than at the periphery. So the density for at negative temperature, the density decreases from inside to outside. So whatever the position of the test vortex, the density to his left will be larger than to his right. And you have this picture. Of course, once again, only a detailed calculation can give a support to this result, but the drawing is seems to be consistent with this formula and provides, I think, the mechanism. It's because the density decreases from inside to the periphery. So now that we have evidence this systematic drift, we can write down a Fokker-Planck equation for the evolution of the vorticity that incorporates the diffusion and the systematic drift. And at equilibrium, the two terms cancel each other, they balance, and the Maxwell-Boltzmann or Joyce-Montgomery statistics is obtained. So this will relax towards the Joyce statistics distribution. So once again, this variational principle, this equation can be obtained by maximizing the rate of entropy production at fixed mass and circulation. This can be extended to the case of continuous vorticity field by using this variational principle. This is what Robert and Someria did in 1992. And this leads to a similar Fokker-Planck equation with a diffusion and a kind of generalized drift, although at that time they didn't make the link with Fokker-Planck equations and the drift, but they obtained this term as a term that arises in order to conserve energy with a Lagrange multiplier to enforce that constraint. And this equation will lead to the Fermi-Dirac distribution because of this nonlinearity. And now we can use these relaxation equations to understand why the system does not relax completely towards equilibrium. It's because a detailed calculation shows that the diffusion coefficient is space-dependent and related to the local fluctuation of the vorticity. So in the region where there are sufficient fluctuations, the diffusion coefficient is non-zero and the system will relax towards the Fermi-Dirac statistics. But in the region where there is no fluctuation, for example around the vortex where omega is equal to zero, the diffusion coefficient is zero and this will freeze, there is no diffusion in that case, and this will freeze the system in a maximum entropy bubble. This is supported by simulations. So for example, this is a high Reynolds Navier-Stokes simulation from this initial condition with an ellipse of vorticity plus one surrounded by an annulus of vorticity minus one, the rest being irrotational, and this leads to a tripod. So this will serve as the model. So now if we use this relaxation equation, so just a remark, for simplicity I have written it in the case of only one level, the patch, but the formalism can be extended in a more complicated situation, for example for three levels, plus one, minus one and zero, as the example on the simulation. So if we use this kind of relaxation equation with a constant diffusion coefficient, they will lead the system towards a complete maximum entropy state in the whole domain.
Well, let me just ask a quick question before we go to that part. Do you have a similar argument for a drift in the case of a multi-species vortex gas, or is it not really generalizable to that?
I think it would be generalizable. I didn't do the calculation, but it's relatively new, so I started from the same type of vortices, but we can study the influence of a spectrum of circulations. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it can be generalized with no problem.
Could I ask that question? The diffusion coefficient D, I was identifying from the previous discussion with the drift of a point vortex inward in the case of negative temperature. So I think of the diffusion as more like a drift rather than a diffusion.
No.
But now you have two terms in the equation. One is with the diffusion, now you have another drift term.
Okay,
I don't understand the difference between the two.
There is always a diffusion. This is the easy aspect. You have a diffusion because you have fluctuations. But it is a general phenomenon in statistical mechanics. If you have fluctuations, you must have something else to compensate. Usually it's a dynamical friction. But in the case of point vortices, it's a drift. and it is the result of a polarization process, and the Einstein relation makes a link between the drift and the diffusion. The two phenomena are not independent. There is diffusion on the one hand, drift on the other hand, and the Einstein relation makes a link between the two. But D is really the diffusion coefficient due to the diffusion
of in this equation, the second one from the bottom, the drift term is actually the second term on the right hand.
Exactly, yes. Okay. The diffusion, this is obtained from the Fokker-Planck equation. So the Fokker-Planck equation incorporates the diffusion, the first term. And another thing, usually a dynamical friction, but for point vortices, a drift in this second term. So there are only two terms, always two terms in the relaxation equation, diffusion and drift. Okay, so if you use a constant diffusion coefficient in this equation, this is what you get. So this is a Navier-Stokes simulation. This is the result with a constant diffusion coefficient. The system, by construction, will relax towards the maximum entropy state in the whole domain. And in this case, it's a monopole. So very different from the tripole obtained by Navier-Stokes simulation.
So the right is the simulation of the drift equation.
Yes.
And this is a sequence of states, but you go through a tripod state before you last. Right?
Yes.
T is equal to 2.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, my comment would be that the right hand side is more diffusive. I mean, you can fix up the Navier-Stokes, but you also have the same thing. All you have to do is make the Reynolds number lower.
That's right.
And so in some sense, maybe you're comparing apples and oranges, you know, one which the diffusion is high and one which the diffusion is low. So you're getting two states rather than one.
Okay, but the idea of this...
One has to be careful. I mean, you can't just say it's that. You have to really convince us that the diffusivity is in some sense are comparable. The diffusivity due to Navier-Stokes, the diffusivity due to your diffusion model. I mean, I can imagine setting up your diffusion model. I'm not sure about that since it's a nonlinear process there. But one has to be careful that D is not very much larger than, say, the Reynolds number.
In other words, because you're simulating Navier-Stokes, ultimately you're going to go to something that is very simple.
If you wait long enough, Navier-Stokes will
your time like scales are not.
It's not going to stay like that, it will just diffuse in.
Yes, what we would like to simulate is the Euler equation, so with no discretive. So what we can do is to make very high resolution simulations of the Navier-Stokes equation, but the other possibility is to make a coarse graining using this statistical theory to obtain the same result with a lower resolution. This is what we want. So we would like to compare a Navier-Stokes simulation with a very high resolution with a simulation with less resolution. But of course, in that case, you have to model the stress tensor, and this is a modeling of this stress tensor. But we see that if we model it like this and with a constant diffusion coefficient, there is not a good matching with the high Reynolds Navier-Stokes simulation. So we have to improve the model. But the idea is to compare Navier-Stokes simulation at high resolutions with a relaxation equation, not Navier-Stokes modified by in particular this drift, at lower resolution, but in order to have the same results, because we want to have modeling of the small scales. So we want to compare apples and oranges in a sense.
It seems like what you really want to compare is Navier-Stokes and high Reynolds numbers coarse grain.
Yes. And
but you're also doing the contour dynamics, which is what, you know.
It's another possibility, yes.
Contour dynamics is very, very controlled. I mean, all you have to do is you can actually introduce these small so-called coarse grain length in the calculation. So it's always there. It's not something put on, and it will generate smaller and smaller structure. But one of the things about it is you will find that you have to compute for extremely long times. You know, and that's another thing you're trying to avoid, actually.
Yes, by a good modeling of the filaments.
Yes, so, right. Yeah. What you're really doing is some kind of sub-grid scale model.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But if we make this sub-grid scale model with a constant diffusion coefficient, it doesn't work. But if we now take into account that the diffusion coefficient is space dependent, in that case we have a very good agreement between the two.
Oh, I see. So in the previous calculation, D was taken to be constant.
Exactly. So the idea now, I think it has not been studied in very detail, but I think the idea would be to replace high Reynolds number on a Navier-Stokes simulation by less resolution numerical simulation with this modeling of small scales in order to have at least the same equilibrium state and also the same relaxation towards it.
Yeah, I guess it's apparent that one could model Navier-Stokes for the constant diffusivity for the Planck. So, you know, one got to make it a little bit more flexible.
I think this is sort of analogous to doing a large eddy simulation.
Yeah.
Of high Reynolds number, yeah. Two-dimensional turbulence.
Yeah.
Where you choose a subgrid model,
yeah.
With a constant diffusivity, which,
yeah.
Is not.
Which is
what
not
you
good.
Do, which,
yeah.
Is like a Rand's calculation,
yeah.
Versus a Smagorinsky coefficient,
yeah.
Which is a nonlinear,
yeah.
Model,
yeah.
And the same,
yeah.
Kind of thing you would,
absolutely.
Observe right there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is an extension of the Smagorinsky theory. We not simply add a diffusion, but we must add something else, this drift, in order to satisfy the equilibrium state, conserve energy, etc. But it's an extension of the Smagorinsky equation. We start from the Euler equation, make this coarse graining, so distinguish between large scale and small scales, and want to obtain an equation of evolution for the large scale, the coarse grain vorticity.
Have you tried to do the simulation where you keep D nonlinear, but remove the second term on the right hand side to see what the effect of the drift term is? Remove the drift term, but keep the nonlinear diffusivity coefficient.
So for small, at small resolution, you won't have the right equilibrium state. It will simply diffuse.
Yeah, you will not have a Fermi Dirac. You won't have a Fermi Dirac.
Yeah, you won't have the Fermi Dirac state. You will have a diffusing vortex, but different from that. You won't have a tripod in particular, except if you have a very good resolution. But in that case, for very late times, it will diffuse eventually. Whereas if you have this diffusion and this drift, when t goes to infinity, it will remain a tripod forever.
So the d depends. This is an extra expression for d. It depends on space through omega bar.
Yes.
And what is the expression for omega bar?
Omega bar is the solution of this equation. So at each time we have the
value. I'm sorry. Yeah, clear.
So just from looking at the drift term, that's the drift lag psi is like the velocity cross product, right? It's a drift, right? It goes,
yeah.
EZ cross product so after the velocity. Okay, so you have a velocity. Grading the velocity times the vorticity. Now that somehow has the feeling of a rotation, like a rotational coordinate. V cross omega, for example, is just using the rotational term. And so what you have is a sort of a rotational a gradient enhancer. In other words, what you're really telling us is that this mechanism enhances gradients. It's a kind of what people in the numerical field would call a self-steepener. People don't like to see the diffusive spreading due to numerical processes, so they go in there and they put a steepener in. And what you have done, in some sense, is introduced a steepening mechanism, which is based on a equilibrium statistics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which sounds like a good idea, because the steepening mechanism is not ad hoc.
Okay.
When omega becomes greater than sim or not, the diffusivity becomes negative.
No, it can be shown that so Mezik and Robert have studied these equations, and they have shown that omega is always less than sigma zero. And it has to be on physical grounds, because the first picture I showed you. Yes. Since it's a local average, omega is always smaller than the maximum initial vorticity. And it's consistent. Mathematically, we can show that this is satisfied by this equation. Okay, so now that this is the general framework of the theory, and now we can try to calculate the maximum entropy states predicted by the theory. So first, in the case of stellar systems, I will simply consider the case of collisionless stellar systems undergoing violent relaxation, like in the Lindenberg theory. So the so it's for elliptical galaxies in particular. So the prediction of Lindenberg theory is a Fermi-Dirac sphere coupled with gravity. And we have shown previously that this Fermi-Dirac state is not valid for high star energies because of the escape evaporation of high energy stars. So it has to be truncated, and it would be more appropriate to use this truncated model instead of the Fermi-Dirac or Lindenberg distribution function. But since we are now interested by the collapse instability, what happens at the core center of the system, it is relatively independent on what happens at the periphery of the modeling of the high energy tail. And in order to circumvent this difficulty, we shall work inside the box so that we don't have the escape of high energy stars. So we can use the complete Fermi-Dirac statistics coupled with the Poisson equation inside the box of radius r. So beta and lambda are Lagrange multipliers determined by the conservation of energy and mass. We can show that the structure of the problem depends only on two control parameters: a degeneracy parameter mu, that is the initial value of the distribution function at S0 divided by the typical equilibrium distribution function, and lambda, the important parameter, it is minus E, the total energy, times R, the box radius, divided by G, the gravitational constant, times M squared, where M is the total mass of the system. So this is the control parameter. We are in the microcanonical ensemble, so we know the value of energy and mass, and also the box radius. We want to determine what is the maximum entropy state for these values.
What's the capital E? Is that kinetic energy?
It's kinetic and potential.
Kinetic and total energy.
We are not working with the microcanonical ensemble. I thought we were with the canonical ensemble. I don't know. We didn't fix the energy. We didn't dictate what energy E was going to be. Like a delta function, whatever, delta E minus E naught. So what we have is the canonical ensemble.
Microcanonical. We fix energy. We have a system of N stars inside the box.
Yes.
So energy and mass is conserved. And it seems more appropriate to work in terms of energy and mass than in terms of temperature, because for a long-range system, you don't have equivalence between the ensembles.
Yes.
So microcanonical and canonical are not equivalent.
Yes.
But we have an isolated system, so it's a microcanonical ensemble that seems to be the proper one.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So the equilibrium diagram is the following. So you have the inverse temperature, beta, as a function of the control parameter, minus the total energy. And we have this bifurcation diagram. So on the upper branch, you have non-degenerate stellar systems with a density profile that decays smoothly with the distance. This corresponds to the non-degenerate limit of the Fermi-Dirac distribution. It's on the upper branch, and these are local entropy maxima. Now, on the lower branch, you have global entropy maxima that have a core halo structure with a degenerate core, partially degenerate in the sense of Lindenberg, in the sense of the Fermi-Dirac statistics, surrounded by a non-degenerate atmosphere. And these are global entropy maxima. So in general, we can so you see that you have a competition between a non-collapse state and a collapse state. It's a kind of phase transition. And in between, you have an unstable solution, like in usual phase transition. So we may suspect that in general, the system will relax towards a non-degenerate equilibrium state, because we may expect that the basin of attraction is larger. But this is possible only if the energy is larger than some critical energy, because at this point the upper branch disappears, and in that case you have a collapse instability. The system will collapse, it form a core halo structure, but the collapse will stop when the core of the center will become degenerate, when degeneracy will come into play, and we end up on a true equilibrium state. So the interesting problem is to, in this context of thermodynamics for stellar systems, is to determine whether you have a collapse state, a non-collapse state, depending on the initial condition, and study this phase transition. So I don't develop it further. I will come back to two-dimensional turbulence, so the computation of equilibrium states. So in 2D turbulence, vorticity can be positive or negative, and this gives a wide variety of structures: monopole, translating dipoles, rotating dipoles, tripoles, etc. And we can use the statistical mechanics to obtain a prediction and classification of these vortices according to the initial condition, according to the integral constraints that characterize the initial condition. But in the general case, we cannot make the approximation of a single level as we did initially, a patch of uniform vorticity. We have to take into account a large number of vorticity levels. So now the Fermi-Dirac statistics is replaced by a superposition of Fermi-Dirac statistics for each vorticity level sigma. So you have to sum over all the vorticity levels sigma and introduce a Lagrange multiplier for the conservation of the area of each vorticity level. So beta is the Lagrange multiplier associated with the conservation of energy, and alpha sigma is the Lagrange multiplier associated with gamma sigma, the total area of the vorticity level sigma. If you prefer, instead of working with the area of the vorticity level sigma, you can work with the different moments of the vorticity, of the fine-grained vorticity, and you have a very large number of moments, infinity in fact, to take into account in a general situation. So you have too many control parameters in the viewpoint of the statistical mechanics, and consequently it's difficult to have a clear picture of the bifurcation diagram in parameter space because of all these control parameters. So we have considered the particular limit of the statistical theory, the linearized limit, that is obtained in two situations. If we assume that alpha sigma here are quadratic, in that case it can be shown rigorously that the sum of Fermi-Dirac statistics is equivalent to a linear relationship between omega and psi. It's multiplicator, Lagrange multiplier alpha sigma are quadratic. The other possibility is when beta sigma psi is small, so that you can make an extension of the formulae of the statistical mechanics in terms of this small parameter. And in this expansion, to lowest order, you obtain a linear relationship between omega and psi. So we can make a link with the famous minimum entropy principle that was proposed in 2D turbulence. In this linearized limit of strong mixing of Gaussian distributions, a maximum entropy state is equivalent to a minimum entropy state. Of course, it is a minimum entropy state for the coarse grain entropy, the integral of the coarse grain vorticity square that decays because of coarse graining, because some fluctuations are lost at smaller scales. And it is different from the fine grain vorticity scale, the integral of the exact fine grain vorticity square that is conserved by an inviscid dynamics. So this coarse grain vorticity decreases because of coarse graining, and in this limit, maximum entropy vortices are equivalent to minimum entropy vortices, so we can make the link with the minimum entropy principle. In addition, this linearized limit or this expansion makes a hierarchy between the constraints. In general, you have to take into account the conservation of all the moments of the vorticity, but it turns out that to lowest order in this expansion, only the first order moment, the circulation, is relevant to characterize the equilibrium state. And if you go to higher order in this expansion, more and more moments are needed. For example, the next order, the cubic order, involves the kurtosis of the vorticity. But to lowest order, when we have this connection with minimum entropy vortices, only the first order moment is relevant. So we can solve this problem of too many control parameters by making this expansion, by making the approximation that we have Gaussian distribution of vorticity. Finally, it turns out that the system does not depend on circulation and energy independently, but on a single control parameter that is circulation divided by the square root of energy. So we can have a classification in terms of a single control parameter. So it's very convenient.
Circulation and energy don't have the same units. Square root of energy is not the same units as circulation.
We had taken a domain of radius. And we have normalized entropy by one, but I thought that these two, this ratio was dimensionless. Huh?
But we have to look at the relation of units of velocity times the length. Square of energy per unit of
velocity square, length square. No, it's velocity. Energy is velocity square, length square. So the square root is velocity length and the circulation also. No, it's okay. It's a, the density is taken to be 1.
Okay,
energy is simply an integral of V square of
V square.
Yes.
Okay. And density, okay, not
density. Well, it's total energy, but with the density equal to 1. We can define energy by integral of omega psi over the whole domain, or v square over the whole domain. So in this case of a square domain and in this linearized limit, we have the following bifurcation diagram. For a given value of the control parameter, you have several solutions to the variational problem that cancel the first order variation of entropy. So you have the monopole, you have the dipole, and you have also more complicated other solutions, in fact an infinity. But not all of these solutions are maximum entropy state. They cancel the first variation of entropy, but we must now consider the second order variation of entropy to distinguish between simply critical points and really maximum entropy state. And in the case of a square domain, we find that the monopole is the maximum entropy state, and the dipole is not the maximum entropy state. The second variation of entropy or of free energy are not always negative. So this has to be rejected. We also observe that you have, in this range of parameters, you have the possibility between the direct monopole and the reverse monopole. And if the circulation is slightly positive, the maximum entropy state, the state with the maximum entropy, the direct monopole with positive vorticity inside and negative vorticity outside. The reverse monopole with negative vorticity inside and positive vorticity outside is also a maximum entropy state, but it has less entropy than the direct one, so it's kind of metastable state. So this is the case in the case of a square domain. The maximum entropy state is a monopole. And in the case of a rectangular domain, it's the opposite. It's now the dipole that has more entropy than the monopole, and the monopole is no more a maximum entropy state. The second order variation of entropy are not always negative. So we have a kind of bifurcation between monopole and dipole when we vary the aspect ratio. We find a critical aspect ratio of 1.12. Where we have the transition from monopoles to dipoles. We can also extend this classification in the case of a circular domain. In that case, we have to take into account the conservation of angular momentum, but once again, it turns out that the equilibrium structure of the problem in the linearized limit depends on a single control parameter that is a function of circulation, angular momentum, and energy. So you have classification between dipoles, symmetric or asymmetric, and monopole in terms of a single control parameter. And finally, we want to extend this classification in the case of a large domain, ideally an infinite domain. But as I showed previously, we cannot maximize entropy in the whole domain because of incomplete relaxation. It must be maximized only in a subdomain. So we make the hypothesis of maximum entropy bubbles. We assume that there is a domain where mixing is efficient, ergodicity is realized, and the statistical theory can be applied. So it provides a relationship between omega and psi. But outside that bubble, there is no mixing at all, and the flow is irrotational. So this bubble is justified by incomplete relaxation. And we assume that the area of the bubble is given. In addition to the other control parameters, energy, the area of each vorticity level, angular momentum, and impulse. But the bubble is free to deform, and the shape of the bubble is in fact determined by matching conditions with the rotational flow. So now we have to make sure that we have a maximum entropy bubble by analyzing the second order variation of entropy. When we consider internal rearrangement of the vorticity at fixed energy, at fixed boundary, sorry, but also when we consider the deformation of the boundary. So this problem can be solved in the linearized limit, where maximum entropy bubbles are equivalent to minimum entropy bubbles. And in this case, it's relatively simple because the shape is circular with radius a, and we can investigate analytically these stability conditions. And it turns out that the size of the bubble that was initially a free parameter is in fact determined by the stability conditions. If the bubble is too big or too small, it won't be stable by one of these two arguments. So it's only for a specific radius that the bubble will be stable. And it can be shown that this stability argument imposes, in particular, the stability by deformation of the boundary, imposes that the vorticity be continuous at the separatrix between the bubble and the rotational flow. So that the vorticity is zero, that the vorticity is continuous, which is not a priori necessary. So it's determined, in fact, by the stability argument. And this gives a new equation in the problem that will determine the size of the vortex as a function of the control parameter. On the other hand, in the case of monopoles, it can be shown that this stability argument implies that the vortex profile be continuous, be monotonous, sorry. So we can have only this kind of monopoles, like this, or like this. But we cannot have oscillation, otherwise they wouldn't be stable.
What are you drawing here? A physical plane? Or I'm not sure.
No, sorry, it's omega versus
R. Omega
R? Yes, versus R.
Oh, I see.
So you cannot have oscillation in the vorticity profile in this linearized limit, otherwise one of these two stability arguments would be violated. So in particular, vortices with zero circulation are unstable, as we shall see. And finally, in this linearized limit, it can be shown that the equilibrium structure of the problem depends on a single control parameter that is a function of energy, circulation, and angular momentum. So we obtain the following diagram. As a function of the control parameter, we have one of these type of vortices. In general, we have an asymmetric dipole rotating around the center of vorticity. When we vary the control parameter following that branch, the dipole becomes more and more symmetric, so radius of rotation increases, and we have asymptotically a translating dipole. And when we vary the control parameter following that branch, one of the two lobes increases, swallows the other, and we make the link between dipoles and monopoles. So as I mentioned previously, in this linearized limit, maximum entropy states are equivalent to minimum entropy states. So this classification is related to the work by Leaf on minimum entropy vortices. And in particular, he considered two types of minimum entropy monopoles. The monopole with zero circulation, that would be here in this diagram. So Leaf showed that this monopole with zero circulation was stable with respect to axisymmetric perturbation, but in fact it turns out that it is unstable with respect to non-axisymmetric perturbation. And in particular, monopoles with zero circulation evolve usually towards a tripole. And this is mentioned at the end of this article. And in fact, we have found that a quadrupolar perturbation destabilizes this monopole. And this is interesting because this quadrupolar perturbation has a nice structure. You see that if these two quarters come to contact, it will generate a tripole instability. The other possibility is that these two quarters go in that direction forming a dipole, and these two in that direction forming another dipole. So the instability would lead to two dipoles translating in opposite direction, and this is sometimes observed for unstable vortices. So it's consistent with the structure of the quadrupolar perturbation. And if considered another type of minimum entropy monopoles, the monopoles with omega equals zero, big omega, where omega is the Lagrange multiplier associated with the conservation of angular momentum. And these monopoles are stable and would be in that range of stable monopoles. In that case, we have taken into account explicitly the conservation of angular momentum. So we have all family of minimum entropy monopoles. And leaf monopole is obtained when the Lagrange multiplier associated with L is equal to zero. And this can be justified physically by realizing that angular momentum is not a real constraint because it can be satisfied by ejecting some vorticity far away without changing energy and circulation, and we store angular momentum in the tail. So we can, in a sense, we can relax this constraint as opposed to circulation and energy, and this would lead to a leaf monopole with omega equals zero. So to conclude, I have presented some analogy between two-dimensional vortices and stellar systems. Of course, the physics of these systems is very different. These are 2D vortices are described by equations of fluid mechanics, stellar systems by equations of stellar dynamics. But nevertheless, the problems and the methods are relatively similar. So why these two systems are similar? It's because they form structure. In the case of stellar systems, these are globular clusters or elliptical galaxies. And in the case of 2D turbulence, these are vortices like Jupiter's red spots. The statistical mechanics of stellar systems is interesting to describe the gravitational collapse to determine, according to the initial condition, if we have a collapse state or an equilibrium state, so to study the transition between equilibrium state and collapse structure. In the case of 2D turbulence, the statistical mechanics can be used to obtain a classification between the rich variety of structures that we find in 2D flows, monopole, dipoles, and tripoles. Now, the relaxation can be described in terms of Fokker-Planck equation. In the case of stellar systems, the Fokker-Planck equation incorporates a diffusion and a friction term, while in the case of 2D turbulence, it incorporates a diffusion and a drift. And these two Fokker-Plancks can be obtained in a self-consistent way by using a maximum entropy production principle. We have seen that an important point that limits the validity of the statistical theory is that relaxation is in general incomplete, so we have to study the system out of equilibrium to see what limits the relaxation towards a true equilibrium state. And finally, in the case of stellar systems, relaxation is incomplete also because you have an evaporation of high energy stars, and we must use truncated models rather than the models given by the statistical theory that do not incorporate this evaporation of stars. Okay, thank you.